I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Mayton.
Hello.
Hello. And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. As well as a bit of a drive-by podding from Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello. That was a bit seductive, wasn't it?
I know.
Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah, just a flyby from me today, just a bit of midnight mass action and then I'm off.
And then he's off. He's off on his little holidays. This week, we're rating Arthurian Quest, The Green Knight, Mike Flanagan's new show, Midnight Mass, British indie Sweetheart, ballet thriller, Birds of Paradise, and Dune, but not that one, the one with Sting. It's getting a re-release. So that's a lot to get through. So shall we get stuck straight in? Please, Neil, it's time for this.
Something's happening here.
A miraculous time. You're gonna let me
in. You're gonna let me in. I think I'm crazy. I mean, what's a little crazy between friends, right?
Okay, so this is Midnight Mass, Mike Flanagan's new TV show. Matthew Leyland, tell us about it.
Yes, so this is from Mike Flanagan, who gave us House on Haunted Hill and more recently Bly Manor, his latest series for Netflix, seven-part series. It's all set on this very isolated island community. And it starts off with Zach Guilford's character. He's basically a drunk driver. He's caused a terrible accident and he's been in away in prison, and he returns to this island looking for some kind of redemption. But at the same time, there's also the arrival of a new priest played by Hamish Linklater, who seems very charismatic and is going to bring people back together because church numbers are very down, and he's kind of driving people back into the church. But then lots of very strange occurrences start to happen. There's, well, you could call them miracles, and there's kind of anti-miracles as well. And things get kind of wilder and stranger and more intense. I feel like I shouldn't say too much more than that for risk of spoilers, but it does go to some very dark places. And there's kind of some riffs on some very classic horror tropes as well. I won't say what they are in case that gives anything away.
Well, this sounds like right up Jamie Graham's street if this is horror tropes. You and Matthew are the two that have seen this. Matt and I haven't because we're slackers. So did you like it?
I really liked it. I mean, I don't think it's of the standard of The Haunting of Hill House, because what is, you know, I think that's one of the great TV shows of the last 10 years, be it horror or anything else. I'm also a big fan of Bly Manor, which I know a lot of people aren't, because it's not a straight horror. It's very sort of character-based and a lot of romance, and it sort of really takes its time. And some people were disappointed, but I thought it was marvellous. And this, again, I love. I mean, it's seven episodes long. It's very, very talky. I don't think it's going to be for everyone. If you're sitting down thinking, right, I'm going to get loads of scares here, then it's not the show for you, because there's long, long monologues discussing faith. It's kind of about fundamentalism and systemic corruption. It's a very, very personal show to Mike Flanagan, who was an altar boy. He was raised up, you know, very religious. He's been sober for 3 years, because another thing this program deals with is addiction. And it's a lot of kind of talking around those subjects, trying to believe, is there a God out there? How can we keep faith when, you know, so much is wrong in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So I think some people may find it really quite tedious and go, like, you know, cut to the scares. Now, when the scares do come, they're brilliantly marshalled. They pop up maybe one an episode, and they're always superb. Flanagan's very, very good at that. So I really like it, but I don't think it would be for everyone, is the short answer.
It wasn't very short, Jamie, but thank you.
No.
Matthew, did you enjoy it?
I'll give a short answer, yes.
Yes, good.
Go. That's good.
But why?
Yes, I liked it a lot. It's very slow burning at first, but it's very rewarding in the end, especially the last two or three episodes. They really ramp it up, and you do get a lot more action, more scares, more horror. So it feels like a very rewarding payoff, because at first there's loads of characters to be introduced and to take in. So, and you are kind of getting used to this whole community, this whole setting. So that can take a little bit of time, but once as it progresses, you do get to know the characters more, and the intensity ramps up, and it's I found it very satisfying by the end. It has a proper ending as well. It doesn't, you know, obviously they could be another season if they wanted to, but at the same time, it does feel very complete in itself, which I enjoyed a lot about it.
Oh, I'm sold on that already. There's nothing worse than watching a show that just is suspended at the end, and you're like, oh, I've put in 7 hours and I haven't even got a finale. What would you liken it to then? Is there another show or a film that you would sort of put this in a bracket with?
It kind of reminded me a lot of, I mean, I haven't read much Stephen King, but obviously I've seen a lot of adaptations. It did remind me of, there's a very sort of Stephen King vibe to it. And obviously Flanagan did Doctor Sleep a couple of years ago. So I don't know if that was a big influence on him. But yeah, the combination of religion and blood and weird things, weird, inexplicable things happening. There's a few child characters as well. I should say it's a really good cast as well. It's got like Flanagan regulars like Kate Siegel, who's his real life wife, and Samantha Sloyan is the kind of most fundamentalist person on the island, who's just absolutely terrific. She's so intense and pitiless, but you know, you can't stop watching her. And it's also got Henry Thomas as well, who's in Haunting of Hill House. Mm-hmm. He's now playing middle-aged dads, which makes me feel really old.
I know that. Gosh, the time has gone by.
It's alarming.
It's also got Rahul Kohli in it, who was in Bly Manor, and he plays the sheriff in this, and he's again absolutely terrific in this. And I think Matthew's spot on with the Stephen King reference, because the thing that Flanagan and King really, really share is, despite the fact they're all into their horror and they go to really dark places and really nasty and bloody and all of that, they don't shy away from it. They are at heart humanists, and they really, really care about characters and take time with characters. That, you know, it's in all of Flanagan's work, be it Gerald's Game, which again, Stephen King adaptation, Doctor Sleep. You go right back in all his Netflix shows, he really loves his characters and builds them up. And, you know, this has so many scenes where it's just a camera trained on two people talking for like six, 7 minutes. The actors must have loved it, because actors always like that, where their performances aren't being chopped into tiny little pieces. So I think if you love your Stephen King and, yeah, you like sort of colourful characters who you really get to know, then this probably is for you.
Annabeth Gish as well, we should mention her. She's really good as the community doctor.
Totally sold. What about you, Matt? Are you going to be watching this?
Probably. It's just I've never watched Haunting of Hill House or Haunting of Bly Manor, so maybe I should watch them first. But I find it just so hard to find the time for TV shows these days.
They're long episodes. A lot of them are over an hour long.
It sounds like a juicy thing, though, because I was a bit disappointed. Mm. My last TV foray was 9 Perfect Strangers, which I didn't find very satisfying. This sounds like it could have a bit of meat on the bone that I probably get something out of. So if you fancy watching Midnight Mass, it is on Netflix from this Friday. You can binge to your heart's content. Now, Jamie, do you want to stick around for Green Knight, or are you buggering off?
I have to bugger off, but I do. I'll just say this before I bugger off. Green Knight, absolutely wonderful. I love it. That's my only contribution.
Saddle up, squires. It's time for this.
And what do you hope to gain from facing all of this? Honor?
That is why a knight does what he does.
Are you ready?
This is The Green Knight. Matt, you gave it 5 stars.
I did.
Tell us about it.
So this is written and directed by David Lowry, who made Ain't Them Bodies Saints, Pete's Dragon, The Old Man and the Gun, A Ghost Story. So extremely varied filmography there. And this is adapted from a medieval epic poem from a sort of unknown author. And it's in the sort of Arthurian tradition. Basically, we're following this character. I'm going to go with Gawain for this thing. But throughout the film, people
they struggle on the pronounce it differently all the way through, don't they?
So Sean Harris, who plays the king, you know, who we're kind of to believe is Arthur, calls him Garwin.
Yeah.
So, just whatever you fancy. But I'm going to go for Gawain. And he's a bit of an unsavory fellow. After this kind of really striking visual, we see him, you know, his head bursts into flames in this sort of striking opening visual. But then we just find him, he's in a brothel on Christmas Day, you know, which kind of sums up perhaps what you need to know about the character at this point, and heads to Camelot. And turning up that day is the Green Knight, who's played by Ralph Innocent Vinci from The Office.
Yeah. And does he throw a kettle over a pub?
Well, near enough. He's basically a big sort of tree monster. And he comes with this challenge where he basically says, you know, strike me and you'll get returned with the same blow 1 year hence. And sort of, you know, you're a bit unsure of what's going on. The king, played by Sean Harris, seems to think, you know, it's a bit of a trap. But the sort of headstrong young Gawain just basically goes for it and chops his head right off. Immediately, the Green Knight picks up his head and promises, you know, he's coming back for Gawain's head 1 year hence. So this basically sets Gawain off on a year-long sort of epic journey where he's looking for his own version of knightly honour, trying to find his way in the world, trying to kind of, you know, prepare for his death, basically. And along the way, he just meets, it's sort of like a picaresque story where he meets lots of different characters and he gets a fox companion as well.
That talks. So, I mean, what's not to like? Yeah, it's quite hard to distill in a description of what it's about, because it's about so much, really, isn't it?
It's that kind of film you immediately want to watch again, really, I found, because there's so much going on. And I basically didn't even really say then that there's like his mum seemingly is kind of summoning the Green Knight at the beginning. So, but
well, she's Morgana, entirely, isn't she? He is the nephew of the king. I think we should presume his mother is Morgana, who possibly.
But it's interesting
has evoked him.
I think that is the case. But as with her, as with King Arthur, they're not actually named. So Arthur's only ever called King. So, you know, we kind of presume he's Arthur, but it's left more vague than that. And yeah, so much throughout this has multiple meanings, even right down to the ending is very, very open to interpretation. It's kind of, you know, it is a dense thing to take on. It's not a kind of, you know, lighthearted fantasy romp, but I think it is extremely rewarding if you kind of give it that time. And I'd say it's Dev Patel's best performance yet.
Agreed.
Which is kind of saying something following like David Copperfield which I loved, you know.
Did you like it, Matthew?
I find it hit and miss, really. Yeah, I like patches of it. I certainly like the tree. I like the tree. All his scenes were great. But yeah, the whole setting out, the whole that big ceremony and that fight at the start. But yeah, I just found it as it went on. I just found it it's got too obscure and inexplicable. I really kind of couldn't engage with it after a while. It kind of ebbed and flowed for me. With all, you know, visually, it's very, very beautiful. And yeah, Dev Patel's terrific in it. And you get lots of other, you get Alicia Vikander and at least two roles pops up along the way.
Because that's another of those things that is just totally up for interpretation. Because, yeah, she plays this kind of prostitute in the brothel early on. And then later she plays this kind of lady of quite high standing that he kind of ends up staying at this house where she lives with this sort of lord who's played by Joel Edgerton. So it's a really kind of great cast throughout.
Yeah.
And there you're sort of like, is she just playing two roles for fun? Are we supposed to presume it's like a variation on the same person? He kind of doesn't seem like he recognizes her or anything, does he? So there's no kind of suggestion of anything like that. But then I kind of love that side of it that you're like, am I supposed to be thinking these are sort of two sides of a coin or, you know, or what?
I sort of thought it was a bit of a Jacob's Ladder scenario. For my interpretation was everything that we're seeing is his vision of his own quest the minutes before the end comes, if it does or doesn't. That's up to you to decide at the end. But I love the fact that you can interpret it any way you want. And what you're seeking in this film, you can find in it as well. So if you're looking for a man trying to sort of redeem himself, you might get that out of it. If you're looking for a sort of fantasy with talking foxes and giants and beheaded women who sort of float about in the woods, all of that you're going to get. If you're looking for something that's about faith, you might get that out of it. There's all sorts of things you can get out of it. I think it's so dense and layered. And as you say, Matthew, just beautiful. I mean, this is a gorgeous, gorgeous film. And
if you're looking for a film with nude giants as well.
Nude giants, who isn't?
Like, you know.
Tick that box. Yeah. And if you're looking for some travel porn, this was all filmed in Ireland, which frankly, when can I get there? Because it looks beautiful.
And it also has kind of elements of that sort of survival thing. Not, it's not full on like Revenant level, but you know, he really kind of goes through the ringer, and like it's a very sort of physical performance from Dev Patel. And you know, he's often, you know, down in the dirt and everything, you know, it feels very
eating
sort
monkey
of,
mushrooms.
Yeah, it's very sort of physical and earthy like that, you know.
I did find it a bit Monty Python at times, a bit reminding me of Holy Grail.
Oh no, were you like expecting him to have a person with coconuts walking behind him?
Okay, yeah.
And like, yeah, it's only a flesh wound. A flesh wound.
Yeah, especially when the fox started talking.
I mean, no, that reminded me of the Lars von Trier film. Yeah.
Yeah,
I was like, oh my God, it's going to start having like disgusting things happening in its stomach. Chaos. Yeah,
actually a small quibble for me as well was I thought the for such an earthy film and everything, I actually thought the fox wasn't the best CGI I've seen in terms of an animal. It just, in the sense, I mean, it was obviously kind of nicely done, but it was 100% CGI. You never once thought there was a sort of a real fox there. I think Depeter actually had like a stand-in ferret there at times.
He did, yes. A like, ferret.
I'd have liked it if you had, you know, if they used a bit of real fox and then, you know, use CGI when they needed to.
Is it easy to use a bit of real fox though?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe they're very tricky to train.
But, I mean, I imagine so, but
they're like temperamental, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, they are in my garden. I just found a fox wee in my garden. Weed in a bowl I left out by accident. So, I mean, if you have that on set, you don't want that, do you, Fox Wee? Anyway, we digress. I would highly, highly recommend this film as a real escapist sort of film that will make you think and talk about it afterwards in the pub. You would too, Matt.
Yes, I would definitely.
But how not about you, Matthew?
Not necessarily. No, I'd say, you know, I'd just give a few caveats and say, you know, it's not perhaps the movie you think it might be.
Yeah, don't go in expecting like a straightforward fantasy adventure quest, because we've had to wait a while for it, because obviously it came out in the States a while ago, had to kind of release issues over here. But now it's coming, it's getting an Amazon Prime Video and a cinema release on the same day. So, I mean, I've only seen it on the small screen so far. I would like to see it on
the big screen. Oh, it'd be gorgeous on a big screen, wouldn't it? Yeah. So that is out on a small screen and a big screen on Friday. Go and see it and let us know your theories. Okay, shall we move on? And it's time to go on holiday, sort of by mistake, with this.
I knew you'd ruin this holiday for everyone. You always do.
Life is not fun all the time.
I like you a lot.
This is your holiday too, you know. You're allowed to enjoy yourself.
Sometimes I have no idea who I am.
That's the thing about being on holiday, you get to be whoever you want to be.
All I know is things are different now.
So this is Sweetheart. Matthew.
Yes.
What's this about?
This is a British comedy drama from a first-time writer-director, Marlene Morrison. And the main character is a teenager called AJ, who's your kind of classic, surly, grumpy, awkward teenager. She's also just come out as well, so she's kind of dealing with that as well. And she's gone on to a coastal holiday park with her mum, played by Jo Hartley, who everyone will remember from the This Is England films and TV series, and her older sister, Sophia DiMartino, from the recent Loki series, and her younger sister as well. And this kind of follows these characters over this week. And AJ kind of, she meets someone else as well. She begins to find stirrings of first love. And all the while she's kind of dealing with these tensions, particularly with her mum and her older sister. So it's kind of a coming out movie, but it's also a family movie as well.
We should say it's a comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy. Yeah, kind of the classic British away on holiday movie too. So it's all these things.
Yeah, I mean, it totally is a holiday we've all been on, isn't it? Having a week in a caravan at the British seaside. In this case, it's actually in Dorset at Bridport, and is actually a place I actually have been on holiday with my family. Yes. So this was very special to me. I have been that kid, but not a surly teen. I was a Wellington booted child prodding at things on the beach. But yeah,
you were the younger sister in this.
Yes, film, exactly.
Yeah, how are you?
I was doing this caravanning holiday, but I loved this because I felt like this was a bit of Adrian Mole, a bit of Makeup, the film we saw that was also set in a.
That's what I was going to say. That's what struck me, that it's almost like the comedy version of Makeup.
The lighter side.
And
I just thought, you know, that it really was very sweet. And felt sort of really real in the awkwardness of teens. And, you know, there's one point where her mum says, "What's wrong with you?" And she says, "I'm 17, everything's wrong with me." And it's like so true. When you're 17, it's just like, oh my God, this is all so awkward, so embarrassing. And it has this really droll voiceover, doesn't it? There she's sort of discussing the horrors of a teenager having to go on holiday to somewhere where, you know, they've got a magician in the bar every evening and the only Wi-Fi is in the bar. And you've got to share your sort of quarters with your sister who's pregnant and her delightful boyfriend. Steve, the boyfriend, was just this lovely, lovely, sweet character. And I loved that in this family dynamic, there wasn't someone horrible. Everybody was really kind and well-meaning. And there wasn't anybody really sort of having a go at her for coming out or the way she was behaving. They all cared deeply about her and were just being kind. And she was just finding it all so annoying. So I just really, really enjoyed it. Did you, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely loved it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite films of the year.
Me too.
Yeah, it was absolutely delightful.
Yeah.
If you laid out the basic story, it does go to some quite familiar, predictable places, but the characters are so believable and the performances inhabit them so much. And like you say, I mean, it's so generous to all its characters as well. I mean, they all kind of have their moments. It really captures the different sense of these different characters being at different points of their lives, like the middle-aged mum and then the slightly older sister and then AJ herself. It really captures all of their viewpoints. And it's just really, really funny as well. I mean, right from the start, there's that line right at the start about spotting some cows out the window. I mean, I was just laughing away immediately.
Like everybody's parents on car journeys are like, "Ooh, look at the windmill." And you're like, "Oh, are we there yet? Jesus, God, why do we have to look at stuff?" It just really does capture a real sense of a British family. And Nell Barlow playing AJ, I just think she's so good in this as well.
Yeah.
So awkward, but, you know, really wears a heart on her sleeve. You can see all of her emotions on her face. She's got this sort of rubbish haircut she's given herself, and she's sort of trying to shrink into herself. She wears these clothes that cover her body, and she's just not confident in herself. But you really see her blossom during this week and sort of come into herself via this relationship she sort of strikes up. I loved it. I thought it was great. And made on such a small budget. I mean, you can sort of tell that when they have scenes that are set in the bar area and there's only about five people in there. Like, you can see the budget constraints. It's part of the British Microwave project. So, like, really, really small budgets. And they've done a brilliant job with it.
Yeah, it's a great debut.
Yeah, I'd like to see what she does next. It's kind of a bit sort of like a more amusing Clio Barnard sort of thing, isn't it? Feels very authentic and true, but is also very sweet. Also reminded me a bit of Days of Bagnall Summer by Simon Bird. The extreme embarrassment of just being with your parents and how they're awful, but the parents are just trying not to annoy their offspring.
I really warmed to Nell Barlow throughout it, but right at the beginning, I almost felt she was a tiny bit on the sort of Kevin and Perry sort of spectrum. And so it took me a little while to warm to her, but I really liked Ella Ray Smith as well, who plays Isla, who's this like lifeguard that she sort of falls for while she's there in the holiday park. Well, it is funny, like you've said, there is some sort of real drama in there as well that feels kind of, you know, real and sort of affecting, like between different characters, like between the sisters and between the mum and AJ and between AJ and Isla obviously as well, that I thought there was actually some proper sort of, you know, drama and emotion in there as well as just being, you know, quite funny.
Yeah. And also I loved that there was this sort of budding romance between the mum and the magician that played really amusingly. Yeah, the magician was fantastic, wasn't he? It was just like, I would totally go to that bar to see you and Miss Bendy, your assistant or whatever she was called. And his terrible dad jokes, really enjoyed it. So I'm going to highly recommend this one. I like this as much as The Green Knight. This is a 5-star for me, as along with The Green Knight. What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I liked it more than The Green Knight. This is my favourite movie of the week, easily.
I would give this a warm-hearted 4 for me. A hard recommend still, nonetheless.
Indeed. Okay, so that is out in cinemas tomorrow. So you can see that on the big screen. I would suggest taking, you know, like all of your seaside cornucopia foods with you. Okay, so that is Sweetheart. Okay, it's time for alternative line reading. And I think Matthew's probably going to get this. I'm going to do it in a French accent, because why not? I fart in your general direction.
That is...
I know what it is. I'll let Matthew guess.
Go on then, Matthew. What is it?
It's Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It is.
Don Cleese.
Yes.
In the castle.
Indeed.
I don't want to talk to you no more, you empty-headed animal food trough whopper. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries.
Is there someone else up there we can talk to?
No, now go away or I shall taunt you a second time.
It's time for our penultimate film. Let's get our bally togs on for this.
Just because you were number one once does not mean you will be again.
I will be number one. Who are you?
I'm Kate. I'm here to win the prize.
They pick one girl and one boy for the contract for the Paris Opera Ballet.
Light, léger.
She's testing you. She's torturing me too. Anyone who partners with Felipe will be the better dancer. He's the key to the prize.
This is Birds of Paradise. Is it about birds or about flowers, Matt?
This is actually about young ballet students, but there is a bit of bird imagery in there, you know, if you're after that sort of thing. And so this is one of those films I went into knowing really very little about when I watched it. And it's written and directed by Sarah Adina Smith, and it's based on a novel called Bright Burning Stars. At the core, it's we're following two young ballet students at this academy in Paris. And one of them is Diana Silver's Kate. And Diana Silver's, you might recognize from Booksmart and Ma. And she was in Space Force as well, the Netflix comedy. And she's basically come over from the States. She's obviously a bit out of her depth, you know, she's kind of new. It's quite cliquey there, obviously, as well. The other sort of, you know, character we follow is played by Christine Frozeth. That's Marine. And she's been there for a while. She's also harboring some kind of trauma because her brother kind of, you know, committed suicide previously. And there's this ongoing sort of tension because from the beginning, we know it's building down to this key kind of recital where they're sort of competing for a big contract. So there's a kind of a countdown element to it because you know this thing's coming up. And so I sort of, from the beginning, I was quite intrigued because that countdown gave it a bit of urgency and there was, you know, sort of, you know, a bit of interesting tension. And obviously there's this top boy there who's kind of the best male dancer that they kind of want to be paired with. Then I just found as it went on, I was sort of less and less interested in it. It just sort of didn't really go anywhere for me. And it sort of starts off a bit sexy, you know, and suggests there's going to be a lot of sort of sexual tension there. But I felt that fizzled out a bit. The dancing's not particularly exciting or particularly well shot. So it's not one of those films you'd say, oh, you know, watch this for the dancing alone. And then it's sort of not weird enough. Like, it's a bit odd, but it's not weird or crazy or
not Black Swan scary. Then
no, exactly. Yeah, it doesn't go far enough to be like a sort of camp classic. It just ended up feeling a bit flat, you know, like some kind of characters come in, it's some sort of story developments happen, but none of them particularly exciting or satisfying. And by the time the actual ending came, I really was a bit like, ugh, you know, that was just very, very underwhelmed. How did you find it, Matthew? Because you've seen it as well.
Yeah, absolutely the same. I thought it started off really promising. So you get like a slapping fight in the first 10 minutes. I thought, this is going to be great. This is just going to escalate from here. But yeah, like you say, it just kind of fizzles after that. And it gets a bit dark, but not really that dark. And it just kind of pales in comparison to all the other dark ballet movies like Black Swan, the Red Shoes. I mean, even Suspiria, Red Sparrow. I mean, that was kind of ballet. Or if you want to watch like a really good day-to-day workings of a ballet company, there's Robert Altman's The Company, which was I thought great. But yeah, it never really went anywhere. And you've got like Jacqueline Bisset as a really kind of draconian tutor, but she's not really in it enough to make an impact. And she has this weird kind of scene where she's threatening to kill a mouse, but that never really goes anywhere either. So there's always kind of missed opportunities.
I wonder if it's sort of like Black Swan for teens. Do you think it's sort of, it's not aimed at you, it's aimed at perhaps teenage viewers who might, you know, it's a starter pack for getting onto your darker wares. I don't know.
I actually did think that a bit when I was watching it. I was thinking, well, this is clearly aimed at people younger than me. So, you know, there is that to take into account. But yeah, even then, I still didn't think it was great. But if it leads you on to those other things, you know, it's no bad thing. But yeah, it just felt like there wasn't enough drama to it, really. And then it's this kind of, they're sort of frenemies where they kind of, you know, come in and out of their sort of friends. Again, there's almost a bit of like sexual tension between them that never really kind of materializes. You know, it's just, so it just, it kind of flip flops one way or the other without ever really getting really sort of exciting or satisfying or anything.
Oh, well, never mind. It doesn't make you want to go and do some ballet.
No. They go to these clubs where they sort of take drugs. And some of those sequences, I've almost found a bit cringy, actually. But again, maybe that's just my age. But I found some of the where they were sort of tripping and dancing a bit cringe.
Yeah, this is not a pirouette extravaganza of a film, more of a bit of a fall and bring in the understudy. Okay, so that is Birds of Paradise. And that is available on Amazon from Friday. Okay, it's time for Plain Talking. And this week, it's Apple Box. What's an Apple Box? Is it a box for apples?
I guess, is it something that actors stand on? So to make if there's any big differences in height that might make camera angles tricky, is that it?
Yeah, it's basically a box used to stand on for anything, whether that's the camera crew need to stand on it to get a high angle, or yes, if you've got an actor that needs to be up in the frame a bit, it's a box. And it's called an Apple Box because originally, back in the oldie days, they were apple boxes that people stood on. So there you go. It's just a box that shifts around and is used. Sometimes they sit on them between takes, all sorts of things. They use them for anything, just not apples. So there we go. Apple box. Should we go on to our final film?
Why not?
It's this.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
Okay, so this is Dune, not the Villeneuve, but the David Lynch version, which is being re-released in cinemas ahead of the new release. Do we need to know what it's about? At this stage, does everyone in the world know what Dune's about? Matthew?
It's about sand. It's about worms. It's about warring families. It's about a young man called Paul, who could be the messiah of the future. It's David Lynch's third film. He was just coming off a big success with The Elephant Man, which he got an Academy Award nomination for. And he was offered Return of the Jedi by George Lucas, but turned that down and instead did another big budget epic sci-fi movie.
So this is his Star Wars of his career.
It is, yeah. And it came out the year after Return of the Jedi. And I don't know if you remember, but I remember it being marketed like the new Star Wars, with even like activity books and colouring books.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so not a film for kids, really. Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that's been much derided over the years, and people talk about it as the sort of, as a flawed thing. I haven't seen it for years. I don't think Matt has either. But Matthew, you've had a little look at it recently in preparation for this re-release. Does it stand up? I mean, is it a maligned failure or is it just rubbish?
I mean, this is quite a big claim, but I'd say it's David Lynch's weirdest film. You know,
what?
You're stacking it up against things like Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead. Yeah. Because it is his attempt to do a big mainstream blockbuster in a kind of Star Wars vein. But I think the issue apparently was that he wanted to do a three-hour cut, but the producer, Dino De Laurentiis, wanted 2 hour, and so did the studio. So they slashed a load out of it and they added a load of intrusive voiceover. And the ultimate result is that the storytelling just isn't coherent at all, because they try, unlike the Villeneuve part one, they try and cram the entire book,
the whole book,
into a 2 hour film. And it's just a muddle. It doesn't really work, especially when you're dealing with such an otherworldly universe and so many characters and concepts and strange names. So they've tried to cram all this into 2 hours. So it just, yeah, it really lacks coherence. But on the other hand, visually, it really does stand up. I mean, I'd say the effects are, you know, as good in there as they were in their day as the ones in the Villeneuve film are today. I mean, it's got people like the creator of E.T., Carlo Rambaldi designed the worms, and they're properly disgusting. Kit West, who did the mechanical effects on some of the Star Wars and Indiana Jones films. So, and plus Lynch's usual obsessions with things like steam and electricity and fire. You know, that all kind of comes into play, and the costumes are terrific and the sets are great.
But I don't remember the still suits being that actually different from the new still suits, actually. I think they're pretty good from what I recall, and pretty faithful.
Yeah, it's interesting how similar it is in a lot of ways to the new version. I mean, you know, you've got another all-star cast, you know, with all the kind of...
And Sting.
Big name, yeah, and Sting, yeah. Big names of their days are similar to the new one. And yeah, there are quite a lot of visual similarities and the kind of strangeness that threads through it, same as the new one. But yeah, it's just the storytelling, really. It's clearly not Lynch's wheelhouse. He doesn't really do kind of straightforward narrative, you know, build momentum, building the narrative like that. Yeah, he's disowned it, and you can kind of see why. But it is still very interesting, and you know, spectacular.
And it's very much of its time, isn't it? I mean, Kyle MacLachlan there, I think he does pretty well as Paul.
Yeah.
Although he's probably too old for the role, even though he is very young at this stage in 1984. It probably would be quite interesting to watch before you see the new one, because it's so much an 80s film, isn't it? And and it does get quite a bit of it right, I would say. But yeah, as you say, the thing is the clarity. And that's the thing about Villeneuve's film, I think, that is so good, is he takes this incredibly dense novel with all of these different houses, you know, the beefs each people have and the different ways they live, and condenses it into something that's totally understandable and feels universal. And that's something that Lynch didn't manage. And yeah, it might be quite fun to watch that on a big screen, all the rotoscoping on it, where they, you know, they draw on the electricity and stuff after. It's quite quaint to see that in this day and age. Yeah. Are you going to see it, Matt?
I'm holding off because I'm obviously lucky enough to have seen The Villeneuve Part 1, obviously, recently. Because I can't remember this film well at all, I almost don't want to spoil the second half of the hopeful Part 2 that will get made. So what I'll do is I'll wait. Hopefully that will get made. I'll watch that and then I'll revisit.
What do you remember about it from watching it in yesteryear?
Again, hardly anything, just the sort of the sand, the vehicles, like Matthew said, it did have that sort of, you know, that feel of a bit of a sort of Star Wars with the vehicles and the, you know, explosions and things like that, where I don't know if they were like exploding miniatures, but they had that sort of look about them. That's the sort of thing I remember from it. And the worms, obviously.
But then Tremors sort of overtook my worm. You know, in my mind, as you know, as a kid watching films, Tremors was a better worm. It sort of got eclipsed
in my memory. Carl McLaughlin looked a lot older, but obviously when I watched it when I was younger, whereas now you see it and he looks like a baby almost, you know?
Well, that probably says more about you than anything else, doesn't it? And the times and the years that have passed for you. Okay, so that is Dune. It is re-released in cinemas on Friday. Okay, it's time to go now, boys. But before we do, you ready for a reader's question?
Yes.
What's the greatest on-screen boat?
Well, I don't like the film, but the boat that Bond has at the start of The World Is Not Enough, his little one-man thing that he's in, his little attack boat.
Yep.
That's kind of cool. I'd love to have a go on that.
Yeah.
I'm going to vote for that. Better boat than film, I would say.
Yes, just the boat, not the film. Matt?
Me, I'm going to go for a douchey one and say the Moonstone from Dunkirk, because I've actually been on that boat.
Have a little float about on it?
Yeah, well, it was on the Thames for a press day for Dunkirk, and got to pop on there with the sort of vehicle coordinator for Dunkirk. And inside it had a little sign saying like "Made in Chatham," which is near where I live. But it was a fake sign, but still it was exciting.
And so it was made for the film. It wasn't an original.
It was an original, but sort of dressed for the film. So it wasn't actually made in Chatham, but they just added that for the film. Yeah. But it was a real old little boat.
Nice. Love it. I'm going to go for either One-Eyed Willy's Inferno from The Goonies, because that's a cracking pirate ship, isn't it? And I love that it sails off round the corner just as they're all on the beach. And also, I would have to say Rebecca's Je Reviens, I Will Return boat, that is obviously key to Rebecca. I Love that. And also I saw the Wheatley version of that boat because it's still in situ where they filmed that at Heartland Quay. So yeah, I love that. And I love what the bringing up of that boat means to that story. So those are my two. I mean, we could say Titanic is a cracking boat in terms of Jim Cameron's huge set, but yeah, it sank. Did you know?
Oh, spoilers. I was going to watch it this afternoon.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it doesn't end well. All right, well, thank you both for joining us on this chat of film. And we will all say goodbye now, won't we? And next week, what are we talking?
No Time to Die.
No Time to Die. It's actually coming. I'm so excited now. I went through a sort of complete despondency of like just not believing it would happen. And now I'm giddy about it. Are you?
I'm nearly there.
Yes. I mean, we've talked about this a lot in the office, you know, the fake office, but it's one of those films that symbolizes for me like the pandemic so much because it was just the first big blockbuster that moved. It was, we had a cover coming out for it, like and the film moved just as the cover was coming out. So it really kind of symbolized what a big deal the pandemic actually was going to be and how huge this was. And then because it's been postponed a couple more times since then, I don't know, it just symbolizes something like, is cinema really back now that No Time to Die is coming out?
I hope so. And I can't wait to see the big three reveals that have been, people are saying that there's going to be absolute corker reveals in it. So we will see, won't we? So on that note, we will bid our fond farewell. We'll see you next week, same place, same time, to talk about Bond. So say goodbye, boys.
Bye, boys.
Bye.
Bye.